This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It's kind of ballet season, with lots of companies performing the Nutcracker for the holidays, and with the new film Black Swan, a psychological thriller about a ballerina preparing for her leading role in Swan Lake. But you don't even have to be interested in ballet to be fascinated by the new book Apollo's Angels, A History of Ballet, by my guest Jennifer Homans. Her story of how ballet evolved from the 16th century is rich with history about class structure, gender, costume, shifting images of the ideal body, and ideas of what the body is physically capable of. Yesterday, Apollo's Angels was named one of the top 5 nonfiction books of the year by the New York Times Sunday Book Review. Jennifer Homans used to be a professional ballet dancer. She performed with the Chicago Lyric Opera Ballet, the San Francisco Ballet, and Pacific Northwest Ballet. She's the dance critic for the New Republic and teaches the history of dance at NYU, where she is a distinguished scholar in residence. Jennifer Homans, welcome to Fresh Air. Let me start with something I found very interesting. You write, ballet is sexual, but dancers infrequently experience their art as sexual, even when their limbs are wrapped around each other or they are joined in an impassioned embrace. And I will add to that that some of the lifts in ballet require some pretty intimate touching. So why isn't dance experienced as sexual?
Well, I think it depends on who you're talking about. The dancers themselves, I don't think, experience the art as sexual. And the reason for that is really that it's work. And when you're in a state of high concentration over, you know, are you on the music? Is the step being done properly? What is the feeling behind it? Even if it's a sexually sort of loaded scene, it's not sexual between the two people who are dancing. Whether it's sexual or not for the people watching it is another story altogether.
So during, a lift that's so beautiful and graceful and maybe even sexual to the audience, is the dancer ever thinking, were you ever thinking when you were a dancer, is he going to drop me?
I never was thinking that, because within the flow of the movement, you have complete confidence, hopefully, in the partner that you're working with. And so, you know, those kinds of considerations are not to the fore. Now, if you're working with somebody you don't quite trust, or there's a lift that's particularly difficult, you know, then I think there can be a certain tension. And that's something you want to try to get rid of in a performance, I think. One of the great ballerinas once told me, when you start to have a dialogue in your head when you're performing, that's when you know it's gone wrong. In a way, you want to get rid of those words and sort of enter a kind of different way of existing for the time that you're on stage.
A way of existing as sheer music and movement?
That's right. You know, so instead of thinking about what you're going to have for dinner that night, which you could do, because dancers know their steps so well and they are so second nature that your mind can wander. But, you know, to sort of shift into another dimension, as it were, so that you're not thinking about that, but you're in a kind of close synchrony with music.
Before we get into how the ideal image of the dancer's body has changed over the centuries, can you just describe what the ideal ballerina's body is considered today?
You know, that's a tough question. And people always ask that because there is the concept of ballet as something that strives towards perfection and towards a perfect body, that you must have, you know, long legs, turned out hips, arched feet, preferably, some people even say, a small head. But I think that's actually really a misunderstanding and a misconception. Dancers do come in all sizes and shapes. Yes, it helps if you have the facility that the technique requires. But the main quality that makes a great dancer is not the perfection of their body, but really the luminosity of it. It's a quality of illumination. You know it when you see it. You know, two dancers doing the same step, one might have a perfect body and perfect technique. The other one might be much less perfect, but much more interesting to watch. So it's not straightforward as it might seem.
Nevertheless, if we compared a ballet dancer's body today with a ballet dancer of the 16th or 17th centuries, would we see a big difference?
Yes, we would. The dancers of the 16th and 17th century were in the case of the women, more, well, they were just, they followed the aesthetic of their own time. And in a way, you could say we do too. It's a sort of the far end of the extreme of our time, but there are those images of fashion and models and, you know, the ideal sort of elegant and graceful body. And that's the unifying theme throughout, so that even the technique allowed you to modify your own perhaps imperfect proportions. You know, if you're too tall, maybe you would lower your arms a bit so that you don't quite appear so high up. So you might bend them a little bit if they're too long. So you could sort of try to craft your own image. And the other thing to remember about that is that the dancers in the very beginning in the 17th century, it was the man, not the woman, who was the privileged performer. It was really a male ideal at the beginning, and it was only come the 1830s that women started to be the central focus of the dance tradition.
We'll get back to that in a minute, but you know, you write about how dance was originally a very aristocratic art. It was performed for kings. And that there was considered to be a connection between posture, nobility, and character. So how did that sense of ballet being an aristocratic art affect what was expected of how the dancers looked and how they carried themselves?
You know, ballet began as a social art. It was a dance that was done by courtiers. It was done by kings and princes, not people in the street, but aristocrats. So it was done at court by people in social situations. It was not a theatrical art set off from social life. So, you know, the ways that people moved had to do with the ways that they moved in their lives. Like, for example, if you have a reverence, a bow, which is still performed today in classical ballet, both in dances but also at the end of most dance classes, that's the same bow that you would see in a painting of courtiers leaving their king. And how far they bow, how deep they go, was a sign of respect for the monarch or for the person they were addressing.
So when you say ballet was performed by people, you know, in palaces and stuff, as opposed to in theaters. But they didn't learn all the kind of complicated steps that we know.
Well,
today.
They did, actually.
They did. Really?
They did. You know, Louis XIV was himself a wonderful dancer. He worked very hard at his dance, especially in his earlier years. And he practiced on a daily basis and performed regularly in his own spectacles and productions. So, you know, people did achieve a fairly high level of technique, and it was a lot of time was spent on mastering these noble forms. And really the reason for that is that it was proof of your stature. So it was very important to be able to present yourself in these ways convincingly. Now, the tradition really separates out, and you start to have a more difficult technique that even the most diligent aristocrats can't keep up with, sort of by the end of the 17th century. And then dancers are becoming professionals. And that's when you have more and more separation between the aristocrats who are watching the dance increasingly and the people who are performing it. And the dancers at that point are much more exclusively drawn from the lower orders of society, which is in itself an interesting thing when you think about it, because they are learning in a way to become aristocrats. On stage, they appear as noblemen, even if they're in society emphatically not.
So really the dancers were drawn from the lower classes of society?
They often were, you know. Once you moved away from the kings who were performing, dancers were drawn from the lower orders of society. In Russia, for example, in the origins of ballet in Russia, the dancers were serfs. They were serfs on estates, and their owners paid vast sums of money to have them trained in this European, West European dance form so that they could perform for their masters on a, on a summer's evening in the estate. And in this area, especially with women, there was a very close line between dancing and prostitution and...
Between ballet and prostitution?
Between ballet and... Maybe I shouldn't say prostitution so much, but these landowners would sometimes ask their serfs to take off their clothes at the end of the performance or things like this, where, you know, the line between ballet and art and sex was very thin.
So the five positions of ballet were codified in the late 17th century by Pierre Beauchamp, who was a ballet master who became the king's dancing master in France and was later appointed head of the Royal Academy of Dance. So what are the five positions of ballet, and how did Beauchamp go about codifying them?
Well, the five positions of ballet are the same positions that any child would learn today. First, second, third, fourth, fifth positions. Positions of the feet, in this case in particular. And, you know, Louis XIV realized that if his art form, this great, noble art form, was going to be sort of disseminated throughout his realm and even to other European countries, he would have to learn a way to write it down. And so he asked Beauchamp to find a way to write it down. And one of the things that Beauchamp did was to write down these positions. He did also invent a notation. But the positions themselves are the grammar of ballet. They're the ABCs, the building blocks of classical ballet. So this was a vitally important moment when they were actually codified and recorded. What do they do? The positions of ballet are... If you think of first position, it's really a noble position. You stand, in this case, the feet were not 180 degrees, they were more sort of 90 degrees. So you're standing at ease, with grace, with control, with a sense of symmetry and precision. This was the
So your heels are together and your feet are 90 degrees apart.
That's right. That's right. And your arms are in a relaxed but gracious way to the side. So, you know, this is the position of the high nobility, and the first position is a kind of resting place, a stopping point, the tonic, as one would say in music, of ballet. And the other positions simply map the directions of the body in the ways in which you might travel or move in an efficient and graceful way without any jarring or awkward movements.
So how did dancing on point, dancing on your toes, start?
That's one of the most interesting moments in the history of ballet, because it's really a point at which popular traditions feed into a sort of high operatic, high balletic art. Marie Taglioni is the ballerina that we most associate with the origins of point work. And she was working in Vienna. And in Vienna, she was working at the opera house, but a lot of Italian troops were passing through. And these sort of commedia dell'arte or acrobatic troops often, you know, did tricks. And one of the tricks that they did was to climb up on their toes and parade around. And this kind of a trick was then incorporated into classical ballet, most notably by Taglioni, and sort of given an elevated form so that instead of just stomping around on point, it became an image of the ethereal or somebody who can leave the ground or fly into the air, whose point of contact with the earth is only slight. So, you know, this is a kind of elevation towards the angels and God. And so a trick becomes a kind of high aspiration.
There's an illustration in your book of Maria Taglioni on point, and you point out that her calf muscles are bulging. Would a ballerina today have those bulging calf muscles?
Ballerinas today have more calf muscles than you might realize.
Would they be bulging, or are they shaped differently?
Not maybe bulging quite the way hers were. And one of the reasons for that is that the early toe shoes were not supported in the same way that the toe shoes are today, so that the technique and the demands on the legs were quite different. Marie Taglioni's toe shoes actually still exist. There is a pair in the archives at the Paris Opera, and you can go there and hold them. And they're not new shoes, they're old shoes, which is quite important because you can see where she stood, where they're scuffed, how she danced, and where she danced. And the important thing there is that she danced just on the tips of her metatarsals, not quite on the full point the way dancers do today, and that the shoes were soft, very soft, like a soft ballet shoe, and darned around the edges, so that she had to support the full weight of her body on this metatarsal with no extra glue or, hardened materials, which is what supports dancers today. So her calves were doing the lion's share of the work. And it's not just her calves. Her entire legs are they're very beefy. So she's, in spite of her ethereal, fleeting image, she was actually quite hefty as a physical type.
So which toes are you on when you're on toe?
You're really on the first two. That's the main weight is being carried on the first two toes. And that's because when you're standing on point, that's the axis straight up through your spine, so that you actually have more strength if you're balanced towards those first two toes than if you're sort of edged more towards the pinky toe. If you were on the pinky toe, if you think about it, you'd fall off point just because your ankle would bend the wrong way. So dancers are trained to be mainly on those first two toes, maybe three, depending on the foot.
Now, it's very interesting to read how the role of men and women in ballet changed over the centuries. And yet you say that early on in ballet, and I guess you're talking 17th century, late 16th century here, men were given to virtuosity while women were expected to exercise restraint. You say the relationship was chivalric, am I saying that right?
Yep.
with the man performing technical feats in honor of his demure lady. So why was it the man who was taking center stage and being, I guess, doing more physical feats than the woman?
Well, I mean, this really goes back to the court origins that we were talking about earlier. You know, these are the men who are thought to be the highest members of society. And they are the kings. They are the ones in control. And the women are meant to be sort of the same but less. So the women perform, but they don't do the same kind of extravagant and intricate footwork that the men do. And you can think of it partly as costume as well. The women, of course, are wearing very long, heavy skirts. To actually get off the ground or beat your legs or weave intricate steps with your feet would be very difficult in those kinds of costumes, whereas the men have free legs. And you can see them. So all of this worked towards the man having the more prominent bravura role, and the men and the women being more demure.
So how did ballerinas become stars?
Ballerinas became stars when men, when the male aristocratic dancer was really discredited. And this happened in France. France was the center of the ballet world at this point. And when the French Revolution came, this was the key moment for women. What happened? Well, the hatred and bitter animosity towards the aristocracy during the French Revolution had direct consequences for ballet, which, after all, was an aristocratic art. And so, you know, the day before the storming of the Bastille, the people of Paris stormed the opera. Why should you have this aristocratic art? If you're going to take down the aristocracy, let's take down ballet, too. So the men who were performing this art gradually became less admired And they started to become sort of more acrobatic and to pull more and more from popular forms. The technique changed. And by the, 1830s, 1840s, men are reviled on stage. You know, they're thought to be a disgrace. Well, what steps into the void? Marie Taglioni, other female dancers who sort of take the ideals that had existed in the aristocratic art form and turn them into a feminine ideal of which they are the masters. And so then you get this image of the ballerina on tow in these more romantic era ballets of unrequited love and the romantic themes that carried ballet into the 19th century.
You were talking about the aristocratic basis of ballet, but in the Cold War period, it was Russia that was considered to be the center of ballet, and the Bolshoi ballet was revered around the world. And even when Russia was America's enemy, the Bolshoi was such a big deal in the United States. So how did Russia, when it was a communist country, reconcile ballet with its aristocratic origins?
Yeah, that's a fascinating moment because, as you say, you've got a court art that is very much associated with, Nicholas II and who, after all, is the has an affair with one of the dancers. And when the revolution comes, Lenin actually takes over this ballerina's house, ransacks it, and uses it as his headquarters, as a kind of symbol that, that the court is over and I'm in control. So you would think that ballet would have gone with the imperial court. But in fact, it becomes the sort of centerpiece of cultural life in the Soviet state, or certainly a very important part. But the other thing is that ballets really did change, and they reworked them to the new socialist image. So you had a period where there were lots of what they called tractor ballets. These were ballets about workers with shiny tools remaking the socialist state. On the other hand, you also had classical ballets, petipa ballets, that were redone. Some of the aristocratic etiquette was wiped out, so you didn't have the same kind of emphasis on pantomime and gracious manners. And instead, you had more bravura variations, a kind of muscular quality added to these dances so that they would, in fact, reflect the image of the Soviet state. And, the other thing is that ballet is an art form where you don't need the language in order to appreciate it. So, the Russian leaders or the Soviet leaders could take diplomats of all kinds to the ballet. They didn't need to understand Russian in order to be impressed. So the ballet became a place where foreign dignitaries would be entertained and shown the great cultural life of the Soviet Union. When the country finally opened up a little bit and the Bolshoi, as you said, toured to the West, they were an absolute sensation. I mean, the lines around the block, the cries of wonder and amazement at this extraordinary art form and at the dancers who performed it was part of the Cold War political story.
And of course, there are several Russian dancers who become emigres to the U.S. and who make a big impact here. Baryshnikov, Nureyev, Nijinsky.
That's right. The Russians, before and after the revolution, were leaving Russia in great numbers, and Russian dancers, and coming to the West, and they were the ones that really sort of seeded the tradition here. And many of them, in particular George Balanchine, became key figures in the establishment of what then became an American art form.
Now George Balanchine, the great choreographer who came to the U.S. from Russia, You describe him as the jewel in the crown of 20th century dance. And you say for him, ballet was an art of angels, of idealized and elevated human figures, beautiful, chivalric, and above all, strictly formal. So what did that mean for dancers in terms of what they were taught about how to approach the art of the dance?
I think what that meant for dancers was that their formal training was very, very important. So they spent a lot of time perfecting their technique. Precision was valued enormously. So that, you know, Balanchine was actually a very, very fine teacher. And he did work a lot in the classroom with his dancers. That's where he did some of his most radical experimentation, was actually trying things out on dancers in the classroom. But, you know, a Balanchine class was famous. He was famous for giving multiple repetitions of very basic steps until they were, you know, just ingrained in the body in a way that you could never forget them. So, you know, the sort of very deep formal work was an extremely important part of making a Balanchine dancer.
And you say Balanchine saw ballet as a philosophy of an approach to life. Now, you studied at the New York City Ballet, which was founded by Balanchine. What did that mean to you when you were studying?
Well, you know, I was a kid from Chicago, and I, you know, had not grown up in a theatrical world. My father was an academic, and my mother worked in the university. So I had very little exposure to theatrical people. And when I arrived in New York at Balanchine School, there I was in this kind of little Russia. I mean, they all spoke Russian. Danilova, one of my main teachers, you know, would appear at class, you know, dressed in sort of pastel chiffons and false eyelashes curled and elaborate makeup and hairdos. And there was a kind of very, very old world perfume and etiquette to the life there. So for me, it was quite an extraordinary experience. It was one I struggled with at times because there was also, you know, with that, a very, very clear sort of, as I saw it at the time, authoritarian impulse, so that, you know, you were really expected to do what you were told and you were not meant to ask questions. And, you know, I remember facing one of my teachers and saying, well, I just can't do it that way because I had some theory about why I couldn't do it that way. You know, and she just looked at me with her stick and sort of just prodded my legs and said, you know, Jennifer, more. And that was it, you know. Just do it my way. And so, you know, there was that element to it as well.
Well, I can only imagine because I think this was like the late 60s when you got there.
Yeah, it was actually the mid-70s, but...
Mid-70s, okay.
It was the mid-70s, but, you know, there was still enough of that left, right?
There had been a period of, like, rebellion against authority. The women's movement was you know, still pretty active. You have these, like, old-school teachers with the curled eyelashes and the chiffon and authoritarian, and it didn't fit in with the times at all, I'm sure.
No, it didn't. And, I mean, you know, we all wore our T-shirts, and I was very much part of that whole world of feminism and, you know, doing what you want when you want and all of those sort of beliefs that we all carried around with us all the time. So this was quite a different life. But the thing about it was that it was so interesting, and I could see that there was something incredibly exciting and valuable there. So, you know, I ended up sort of deciding that, you know, you go along and then you see what happens. You know, on s'engage et puis on voit. I mean, it was like that. You know, okay, well, you have to decide to sort of take the plunge, believe and trust what they're doing, and then let's see what comes of it. And, you know, indeed, sort of whole worlds do open out from it.
If there was an authoritarian side to Balanchine's company, it sounds like there was also a very spiritual side. He was Russian Orthodox, and you say that partly because of his faith, he believed that music and dance were sacred arts and that one finds God through the senses. Did you experience that when you were dancing?
Oh, very much so. I mean, that was the reason to dance. And that's the main thing that one experienced on a sort of daily basis. You know, there is something almost religious about ballet, about being a dancer. The commitment, the ritual of going to class every day, of being with people and performing these great works. And when you work very hard and you achieve a kind of coordination and skill in the body, there's a way in which it sets you free. And, you know, if you're doing these beautiful movements to music and you manage to get it all right, which doesn't happen all the time, but when you do, it's an extraordinary and transcendent experience.
And you say that Balanchine had this uncompromising emphasis on now, not holding back, doing it all, giving your all now. What did that mean for you as a dancer?
You know, as a dancer, it was really a kind of concentration. It's much harder than it sounds to focus your energy now and not be thinking about what I'm going to do in 5 minutes or in 5 hours, or what happened before and was it okay, or, you know, so-and-so made me angry, or wasn't that a nice thing for them to say? To just put everything aside, focus on this movement here now, and really sort of throw your full self into it in a way that's not just throwing but intelligent is quite a discipline. So, you know, there was that side of it. I think the other thing it did was it didn't occur to me to think about ballet's history at that time because we were all worried about the now, you know. I never took pictures or had any sense of, you know, the future, or it was all what we were doing right there. It was very peculiar in a way, but it was very engrossing.
Your book ends with you saying, something important really is over. We are in mourning. Classical ballet has always been an art of belief. It does not fare well in cynical times. It's an art of high ideals and self-control, in which proportion and grace stand for an inner truth and elevated state of being. Today, we no longer believe in ballet's ideals. We are skeptical of elitism and skill, which seem to us exclusionary and divisive. So, do you think it's over, and do you think that has to do with the times that we live in?
I do think that something very big and important is over. You know, the whole era that we've been talking about, this great 20th century modernist moment, it is no more. I mean, and, you know, that's not a criticism. It's just a historical sort of fact. I mean, a lot of the people who were important to it have died, and we do live in a sort of different kind of aesthetic era now. If you look back over the history of ballet and you see that at certain points in the history, ballet has been really, really central to culture, a kind of very important thing that people talk about that matters enormously. I think one of the problems is that it is, in fact, more conservative today than it has been in a very long time. You know, we're very concerned today with preserving the classics, with sort of holding on and making sure that they're in good shape and being performed well. There's nothing wrong with that. That's sort of the tradition, and we need that. The problem is that that's not quite enough. And the new work, it seems to me, to be very, very overwhelmed with steps, with a kind of athleticism and bravura that doesn't move people particularly. And, you know, I'm not sure where the vision is or where it's all going to go. It may pick up and find a new spot. And that's certainly, you know, I would be the first person to be on my feet applauding if that were to happen.
You danced until you were 26. Why did you stop?
I stopped because although I still, I mean, I loved to dance. It was an absolute passion with me. And I think I still love to dance when I stopped. But it was almost a message from my own body in a way. I mean, I had had an injury. During the injury, I had done a lot of reading, and I had kind of developed a routine for myself where I would read and write, and I had my kind of control of my own time, and I had my own schedule. And, you know, when I went back to dancing, I just, you know, it was almost like physically, I just couldn't do it anymore. I just didn't really want to. As much as I love to dance, it sounds strange, but I just kind of reached a brick wall. And I think part of what was going on was that I was always pulled sort of towards the life of the mind as well as the life of the body, if you want to put it that way. And, you know, I knew that I wanted to study and to read more and resume my education. I had not been to college. And so, you know, I think I saw it as an opportunity, really, that here was a moment where I could stop dancing and I could start something brand new at an age where I was still young enough to be able to make something of it without too much difficulty. And so I did that. I have to say that stopping was much harder than I thought it would be.
Well, Jennifer Homans, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Jennifer Homans is the author of the new book, Apollo's Angels, A History of Ballet. You can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org. Coming up, our classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz talks about attending an 85th birthday music tribute to Pierre Boulez in Berlin. This is Fresh Air. Listeners to Fresh Air may have noticed that our classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz is an ardent admirer of the French conductor and composer Pierre Boulez. Lloyd's reviews have focused mainly on Boulez's work as a conductor. This fall, Lloyd was in Berlin, where he heard part of a two-week festival devoted to Boulez's own music.
I was lucky to be visiting Berlin just in time to catch the last five concerts in a two-week music festival celebrating the music of Pierre Boulez in honor of the 85th birthday of the great composer, conductor, and cultural icon. Such an in-depth exploration of the work of a living composer is, to put it mildly, extremely rare here. The concerts were in Berlin's controversially modern concert hall, the Philharmonie, and its next-door chamber music hall, which has equally wonderful acoustics. The night I arrived in Berlin, Boulez was conducting the Berlin Philharmonic, which many people consider the world's greatest orchestra. It was the only program he himself conducted, and it was an astounding event. He opened with his own extraordinary Explosante Fixe, a title he explained before the concert as a mixture of the completely spontaneous and wild, like an explosion, and something stable, static, and fixed. This piece, from the early 1970s, is a memorial to Stravinsky and in turn quotes from Stravinsky's haunting symphonies for winds, which was his memorial for Debussy. With its electronic component and its major role for solo flute, dazzlingly played in this concert by the Berlin Philharmonic's famous flutist, Emmanuel Pahud. It's a mysterious and moving work, and thrilling to hear Boulez himself bringing it to life in a rare live performance.
Thank you.
That Berlin Philharmonic concert ended with Boulez conducting Stravinsky's magical early opera, Le Rossignol, The Nightingale, based on a Hans Christian Andersen story. Boulez said that he had heard this as a child, and it was the piece that made him want to be a musician. Boulez's own compositions are famously difficult, serial music that avoids the traditional thematic repetitions most concertgoers depend on to follow a score. Yet piece after piece mesmerized me. Boulez, the composer, is notorious for constantly revising and expanding his previous work, and this festival certainly emphasized that aspect. At one concert, the gifted Finnish conductor Susanna Malki, leading the Ensemble Intercontemporain, the chamber group Boulez himself founded, followed an early solo piano piece, Ainsi's, with its latest incarnation, the exquisite Sur Ainsi's, which extends and redevelops the original with three pianos, three harps, and three percussion instruments. Boulez's friend, the pianist and conductor Daniel Barenboim, ended the festival by playing five of Boulez's very early and delicate piano miniatures called Notations, and after each one leapt from piano to podium to conduct the Staatskapelle Berlin, the orchestra of the Berlin State Opera, in Boulez's stunning later expansions for full orchestra. He brought down the house. I'm sorry no recording of this concert is available. Of the concerts I heard, only the Berlin Philharmonic was completely sold out, but the other ones had remarkably full houses. Boulez himself was always around and was easy to approach by members of the audience. He remarked how old some of these pieces seemed to him and how old he himself seemed to be. Yet his conducting had all his familiar energy, precision, and passion. And after the last concert, when Barenboim insisted that he come on stage to take a bow, he reluctantly accepted the ovation everyone was dying to give him.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix and teaches English at the University of Massachusetts Boston. He reviewed the 2010 Musikfest Berlin's 85th birthday tribute to composer-conductor Pierre Boulez. We're grateful to German Radio Kultur for allowing us to use their live recordings. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Shurrock. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our associate producer for online media is Melody Kramer. Sue Spolin directed today's show. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with Billie Holiday.
But I can weather the storm. What do I care how much it may storm? I've got my love to keep me warm. I can't remember a worse December. Just watch those icicles fall.